This is John Howell Essential Cuts, your daily rundown of the best of the best from today's show on 890 WLS.
Are we back already? Today got completely away from me. I had so many things planned, and the list is still right here in my shirt pocket. I used to make fun of my father, who would carry a little piece of paper and a pencil or pen and write little notes to himself, and I thought, gosh, this guy's old. This guy's addled. He can't remember what he's supposed to do, and yet I now am doing the same thing every day, and I must say this long list of items I was expected to accomplish today, well, there's always tomorrow. Greetings and salutations, and good afternoon, 6 minutes after 4 o'clock. One thing I was expecting to do today was to attend that redistricting hearing at the Blandick Building downtown, as the they're working on the congressional maps, and this is where the public can offer their input, but doggone it, it slipped my mind, and I did not get there. However, good news, and maybe you'd like to join me, tomorrow the state Senate hearing is at Oakton Community College out in Des Plaines, so maybe I'll see you there. More information on that at the Senate website, but I'm sure it was a raucous day downtown at the Blandick Building. Did I hear you say, Kim, that Tony Preckwinkle's bodyguard was a victim of an attempted hijacking, and the key word in your report, he returned fire.
Correct.
See how nice that is to have the means to be able to return fire? I'm seriously considering tooling up for next week's return to the NBC Tower, considering the state of the city.
Well, I have to tell you, I mean, you know, I live right around the corner from NBC Tower, and I have to say, I'm a little nervous when I have to go out at night by myself. I try not to anymore.
I've mentioned this previously, but my guy that I work out with a couple times a week, his son lives downtown in a high-rise at Illinois and Wabash. Now, I know Illinois goes under Wabash, but right in that general vicinity, I think. And he and his girlfriend live in this nice condominium, and it's a rental, because I heard today, as I was pumping the iron, I heard today that once that lease is up, they're getting out of Dodge. And that's a regular story that I hear because of the uptick in crime. So, yeah, the mayor's going to have to do something. The superintendent's going to have to do something. The politicians are going to have to do something. The public's going to have to do something. And if it comes down to being able to arm ourselves, then I know that there's people who are gun control advocates that think that's adding to the problem. But the key to that story, it perked up my ears, he was able to return fire. So do we know if he was fired on? Did some guy walk up to the car because he's waiting for Tony Preckwinkle, the Cook County Board President, outside her home in Hyde Park? Obviously, the guy had a weapon. The perp had a weapon, stuck it in his face or banged on the window or what have you. And was there a firefight? It said he returned fire.
Well, they're being very sketchy about it, but a Chicago police spokesman said an armed suspect attempted to carjack the 57-year-old man.
Yeah.
So.
Nice to have a tool sitting in a holster on your belt for those times. And I understand that you need the training. I understand bad things happen in homes. I get it. Anecdotally, we've all heard the stories. But the fact is, the bad guys are never going to give up their weapons. So at this point, you can add on layers of punishment for them. Not going to do any good. Mark my words. So we might as well just hand everybody a weapon and say, okay, for the foreseeable future, it's like the Wild Wild West. Good luck. Maybe you want to take a course. The president was in Elk Grove Village. I watched the entire speech so you didn't have to. And the only part of the speech that I found interesting today was the obligatory, gee, it's great to be here. Let me run through the obligatory thank yous. He started with the host of the event out in Elk Grove Village. Tyler, our technical director, could I impose upon you for a little hail to the chief, lightly in the background? Here's the president.
And I want to thank Otto for hosting us here at Clayco, one of the Midwest's biggest construction companies. $3 billion a year in revenue, thousands of employees nationwide, and here in Elk Grove, 100% union, not labor, union. Union.
Yes, the president, as is his wont, was riffing here at the beginning of his speech. He obligatorily thanked the governor, of course.
JP, you, governor, you've done...
Actually, JB, but that's okay. JB, JP, whatever.
JP, you, governor, you've done more than about anybody I can think of in any state. I mean that sincerely. You've stepped up. You've always done what you said you're going to do.
Done.
And you've been relentless in getting people vaccinated. In the Midwest, you're leading. You're leading. And it's real. It's not hyperbole.
So I reached down and turned it up and thought to myself, I think the lug nuts are coming loose.
Mayor Johnston, you've done a hell of a job as well.
So we should reach out to Mayor Johnston and see if he wants to pop on. It's a big day for the mayor of Elk Grove Village, that's for sure. All right, now he hasn't hit the wall yet, but and again, this is obligatory. He's 78 years old. I get it. I understand it. I see all politicians struggle with the pronunciation of local officials. We'll get to the state officials, but first, he ran down the Congressional Democratic Caucus from Illinois. He knows these people.
You know, we have 11 members of Congress here. Raja, thank you for hosting us in your district, for permission to come into the district. And I also want to thank colleagues in the House of Representatives, Mike Quigley, Robin Kelly, Bobby Rush, Danny Davis, Jan Sikowski, an old friend, Bill Foster, Brad Schneider, Sean Kasten, Lauren Underwood, and Marie Newman. And I know, for them, you'd all understand it in a different context, but this is a busman's holiday for them to have to come here and another politician speak. You know what I mean? Not a joke, folks. I appreciate it.
Not a joke, folks. Not a joke, folks.
Not a joke. Not a joke.
Okay, so he's going along. Now he gets to the state leadership, which is just a couple little verbal landmines here as well.
Also, we've got state leadership here. Lieutenant Governor Julius here, Stratton, and the Ohio, Pennsylvania.
Oopsie.
The Illinois president, Don Harmon, State Senator Laura Murphy, State Rep Martin Moylan.
Okay, all right, it happens. Look, he's not senile. I know you hear that often on the station. He's not, but he is 78, and he's probably reading this cold, sight reading this, as we used to say in the music business. So now he's up to the union reps. This is a big union rally, so here we go. There's probably two or three lug nuts now that are quite loose, and that front tire is starting to vibrate dangerously.
And we got great labor leaders here, too. Tim, where's Tim?
By the way, that's a little trick when you're trying to decide how to pronounce the word. You just say, where's Tim? Tim, stand up. Do you remember when Joe Biden was calling on somebody to stand up and the poor guy, it turned out the guy was in the wheelchair? That's from several years ago. I'll have to find that one, too.
And we got great labor leaders here, too. Tim, where's Tim? There you go. Tim, thank you. Thank you, pal. AFL-CIO State President. And Jeff Isaacson,
I don't think he ever got to Tim's last name, did he? Let's listen again.
And we got great labor leaders here, too. Tim, where's Tim? There you go. Tim, thank you. Thank you, pal. AFL-CIO State President. And Jeff Isaacson, United Brotherhood of Carpenters, and Don Finn, IBW, and Robert Reeder, Chicago Federation of Labor.
Guys, I've told you many times, please print it out phonetically for me. I don't know the man. So that's not because of any sort of mental deficiency. That's really political malpractice that he didn't have those names. They didn't go through them with him. However, as is this president's habit and has been for the last 50 years in this business, now he starts deviating into riffing about his childhood. And I think instead of the hail to the chief, I think perhaps I'd like to hear something a little more subtle and more elegant here for this cut. Let's go with something off the White Album. Here we go in 3, 2, 1.
We have an expression in that little town of Claymont I'm from. You all brung me to the dance, labor. You're the reason I'm standing here. Not a joke. Not a joke. I can look and I was 29 years old to the United States Senate, 17 days before I was eligible to be sworn in. I had to wait around to be sworn in, not a joke as well. And I won by 3,300 votes and labor, including the police unions as well as the firefighters, stood up and endorsed me. And because I kid with the governor, I said I grew up in a town called Claymont, Delaware. From third grade on, I went to a little Catholic school called Holy Rosary, and across the street from Holy Rosary was the fire station. And the guys I grew up with, they became either a firefighter, a cop, or a priest. I wasn't qualified for any of them, so I had to be president. And so, but look.
No joke. No joke. By the way, cleanup on aisle 89, that cut is not from the White Album. It's from, of course, Revolver. I stand corrected. Apologies. One more cut from the president, and the microphone EQ has changed slightly on this one. But he really, the lug nuts were completely loose. And once again, let's go with Eleanor Rigby, the string section portion without the vocals, please. This is one more from President Biden just a few minutes ago in Elk Grove Village.
One trick is to tell them stories that don't go anywhere. Like the time I caught the ferry over to Shelbyville, I needed a new heel for my shoe. So I decided to go to Morganville, which is what they call Shelbyville in those days. So I tied an onion to my belt, which was the style at the time. Now, to take the ferry cost a nickel, and in those days, nickels had pictures of bumblebees on them. Give me 5 bees for a quarter, you'd say. Now, where were we? Oh, yeah. The important thing was that I had an onion on my belt, which was the style at the time. They didn't have white onions because of the war. The only thing you could get was those big yellow ones.
Not a joke. Not a joke.
You're listening to John Howell, Essential Cuts, on 890 WLS.
I'm a fan of the Better Government Association. I support it, not only here on the radio, but financially as well. I love to go to their banquet every year, which I imagine is coming up soon. Justin Kaufman is a Chicago radio veteran, a media veteran, and now host of a new series from the Better Government Association called The Madigan Rule. Justin, this sounds very interesting to me. Welcome to the Big 89, sir. How are you?
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. I'm good.
Well, I'm guessing that Michael Madigan did not participate in this series nor the podcast.
Well, I don't want to give away the lead. No, I'm still hoping. I have a request in. They haven't said no to the request. I think it would be a great addendum, like the last episode, to sit down and have a long conversation with Mike Madigan. I learned a lot about who he was and what kind of politician he was before my time and even during my time. And I think that, he has a lot to offer in terms of what kind of politician he was and how he ran the state if he wanted to sit down and talk.
I wanted to get to the essentially episode one, which is called Up from the Garbage Truck. But first, is Steve Brown still on duty as a spokesperson, as press person?
I'm not sure how on duty he is, but he definitely is the guy that you go through. So I don't know if it's more like, yeah, exactly. Like, do you just go through him because they're friends or because he used to work for him? You know?
Well, I used to request Mike Madigan on my programs regularly, and Brown would just dutifully say, all right, John, thank you. Duly noted. We have you down here on the list. We'll get right back to you. And that was better part of 20 years, right back to me. So up from the garbage truck, Justin, tell us about the early days of Mike Madigan and how it, kind of set him on a path to become this be-all, end-all, most powerful man in Illinois politics for decades.
Sure. Well, the podcast is really just about, trying to get to know who this guy was, being the longest state house speaker in the history of American politics, not just Illinois, but all the way through the country. There's never been a longer serving state house speaker. He came from the 13th Ward, which is the southwest side right by Midway Airport. His dad was a precinct captain. He came from the Daily Machine, the Chicago Machine, as we know, which was really about making sure you super serve your ward. And if you volunteer and you do good work to make sure that the incumbents are reelected, you possibly could get work out of it and get a job with the city or get a job with the state. And Mike Madigan came through that chain of, if you think of it like sports, like football, he came from that coaching tree.
Yeah.
he came.
Did you ever hear the anecdote? This is true. Mike Madigan said it himself someplace. I read it, that he crossed the old man very early on, Richard J. Daley. He was already in the machine. He was doing some work in the precinct, decided to go a different direction from the then mayor, and he was put on ice for the better part of a year until one day the mayor said, okay, have you learned your lesson? He said, yes, sir, I have, and never stepped out of line since.
Wow, isn't that amazing? I mean, I heard so many stories like that. I also heard, and in the podcast we talk about just, early on, he was chosen by Richard J. Daley to be a delegate for the Illinois State Constitutional Convention, which in 1970, if you think, he was probably in his mid-20s, early 20s, he was chosen by Richard J. Daley to go down and essentially write the rules on how government will be done in the state of Illinois. And you think about that, and you think about Mike Madigan as one of the most powerful politicians, what people told me over and over and over in this project is that he knew the rules so well. He knew everything about the government and how to actually get the job done better than anybody else, and that's why he was so successful. Well, it makes sense if he was there to write the rules when he was such a young guy. The other story I told, people have told me, and is in the podcast too, is just why Mike Madigan went. You know, Richard J. Daley's son, Richard M. Daley, was also at that Constitutional Convention. There was a thought that perhaps Mike Madigan was there to babysit and make sure that Richard M. Daley didn't get out of line.
Yeah. Justin Kaufman is here. He's a Chicago media veteran, obviously. He's hosting a new series for the Better Government Association, The Madigan Rule. You can go to bettergov.org to check it out. You know, you mentioned how smart he was. When you are ruthless and very smart, generally you don't make terrible mistakes.
Right.
It's only recently, and I mean recently in his career, and obviously it drove him from power with the ComEd scandal. We'll see how that sorts out. Let's be clear, he hasn't been charged with anything yet, but clearly he is a person of interest to the feds. Guys that are very, very careful for very long stretches of time, and Ed Burke's in the same category, you never expect mm-hmm. him to make mistakes that will end it just like that. And yet Burke was very, very loose on wiretaps. What are your thoughts, Justin, regarding the end game with the ComEd schedule? Do you expect the shoe to drop on Madigan, or unless somebody really has some evidence that we haven't heard about or seen yet, or even there's no rumor of any additional evidence, does this just end his career but keeps him out of jail?
Yeah, you know, if you really think about it, this investigation has been years long. This isn't something that just popped up when it got into the news in 2019, 2020 about Mike Madigan and possibly being involved in the bribery scandal at ComEd. There have been rumors and talk of him being investigated by the federal government back to 2014, 2015. So it's hard to think that and fathom that there'd be this many years would go by without some sort of formal complaint or charge. And so you wonder, is the federal government really sniffing around trying to get others around him to flip? You see what happened with the perjury charge to his former chief of staff, Tim Mapes, Mike McLean, his longtime friend and lobbyist who was at ComEd, and also Jay Doherty, who you know, longtime lobbyist himself. So the question is the federal government trying to get these guys to flip in some form? Does the federal government have tapes that they're holding on to? You know, we just don't know. But it's pretty telling that the federal investigation has been years long and there still hasn't been a charge on Mike Madigan.
Justin, do you go into the dynamic between Mike Madigan and his daughter Lisa Madigan, and what's going on in her career now?
Well, we don't, you know, Lisa Madigan is very interesting. He's Dave McKinney, who's a great longtime State House reporter, talked at length to me about his relationship with his daughter, but also just about, you know, that was when you talk about, you know, the discipline and things getting in the way of the power and the ultimate, you know, sort of discipline of a powerful politician. That was one of the areas. If you remember, you know, there was this thought of Mike Madigan needing to step aside if Lisa Madigan was going to become the governor of Illinois, that there'd be too much of a conflict of interest. And he almost in his own way couldn't do it. He couldn't step aside to let his daughter take over. But, you know, there's relationships throughout this podcast that are interesting. When there's these old guard relationships that he has with people who used to be in the, you know, back in the day, that the more recent relationships, like the relationship with former Governor Bruce Rauner, for good and bad, knowing Bruce Rauner before he was even governor. I talked to Bruce Rauner. I had an awesome conversation with him, and he's a big part of this, talking about knowing Mike Madigan before they were adversaries down in Springfield. They were actually on the same side, supporting the same issues, through Governor Rauner before being governor, Bruce Rauner's political campaign financing. So it's just an interesting dynamic to see how all these different relationships play out when it comes to, you know, the life and times of Mike Madigan.
Edgar said once that Madigan would give every new government, blue or red, a honeymoon sort of period of time, and yet with Rauner, it was very short, and then it became just, you know, both men just completely dug in. And I was always surprised that with their previous history, when Rauner was just very philanthropic regarding education in the state and his wife, too, that he and Madigan just had such a terrible relationship.
You know, there's something to be said, and John Tillman from the Illinois Policy Institute's in the podcast, he talked a little bit about what, and Jim Edgar talks about this, too, in the podcast, just this idea of, you know, when you run a campaign, you have to, you know, stop the campaign. And with Governor Rauner, there was this, you know, he really went deep in the fight to become governor, calling politicians like Mike Madigan and the state Senate President John Cullerton crooks, calling them corrupt. And then they continued. Remember, they didn't stop. If it was an issue, they went to the airwaves. That was a different kind of politics that kind of started during the Rauner administration. Yeah. That if there was an issue that needed to be done, they played it out to the voter on a 30-second attack ad. And so that there's thoughts that Jim, you know, Governor Edgar and Governor Rauner and others in the podcast talked about, John Tillman specifically, that that was a mistake because that riled up Mike Madigan, who was looking to find a way to cross the aisle. The one thing that's told about Mike Madigan all the time is he's always looking for a deal. That's what makes him such a great politician. He's always looking for a deal. He's not the kind of guy who folds his arms and tries to just pout his way to the top. So it was very out of character for what happened with the Rauner administration, because he did. He said, I'm just going to outlast this guy. And even, there's a great story Bruce Rauner tells about where he takes out the note card when they first meet when he's governor. Mike Madigan sits down, he hands him, doesn't say anything, hands him a note card. On the note card is the name of all the governors that Madigan had served. and essentially
so great.
Sends the message saying, I've outlasted these guys, and I'm going to outlast you as well.
Justin Kaufman, who's the host and producer of this Better Government Association Madigan Rule series, you can find it at bettergov.org. Were there any people who were afraid or reticent or just said, I'm not going to talk about Michael Madigan because he's still powerful even after leaving state government?
You know, more than I would think. You know, I didn't give away too many of the ex-lawmakers or even current lawmakers who didn't really want to weigh into it. I was surprised, though, at the end of the day, how many did want to talk. How many people wanted to not badmouth him, but to set the record straight or to have a conversation about what Mike Madigan meant for the state of Illinois? There were a few. One, you know, I couldn't get the only governor I didn't get was former Governor Rob Blagojevich, who you know, didn't return calls.
He's exclusively tied to WS for his podcast.
Exactly.
Justin,
so maybe
yes.
That's it.
Yeah, he probably
maybe
got
that's
permission.
It.
Right.
Yeah, and but most I was surprised, you know, like I didn't think that Governor Rauner would want to talk about it, and he was very forthright about wanting to at least reflect. That's the one thing about this podcast. It's not setting out. It's not a hit piece. It's not a piece to say Mike Madigan was good or Mike Madigan was bad. It's to kind of tell the story about, you know, from as many different ways to better understand this guy who was much maligned and vilified.
Yeah.
They talk about there was a whole movement by Illinois Republicans starting in 2010 to essentially, quote, fire Madigan. And the polls said nobody knew who Mike Madigan was. Voter understanding of Mike Madigan was like 15% in 2010, and it jetted up to like 72% by 2016 just because of the way that the ads and all the attack stuff that was going around. So it's just an opportunity to better understand who probably – or you could say right now, arguably, the most powerful politician in the history of the state of Illinois.
I think you are spot on with that. Next time, I'm going to talk to Jeremiah Joyce, former alderman, state senator. He has new memoir out.
And yeah, I'll ask him about it.
Yeah, I'll talk about Mike Madigan. It would be nice to talk to him. Justin, I hope you called on our former colleague and longtime friend and still friend, Bill Cameron, for his thoughts on Mike Madigan.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, Bill Cameron's one of the giants of the industry, and what an amazing city and to cover for Bill Cameron. Think about, like, he could have been anywhere in the country. He's in Chicago, and he got to cover the shenanigans, not just in the city of Chicago, state of Illinois. I have nothing but respect for Bill.
Yeah. He called it the greatest show on earth, and he had a ringside seat for it.
I know, right? Cheryl Corley, who's the NPR reporter, she had a show back in the 80s and 90s that I produced on that was called The Best Game in Town, and it was all about city politics. I loved it.
Justin, I could talk much longer on this, but my clock management, as you know, is woeful here. Longtime radio man, I'm woefully late for traffic.
So I completely understand.
I look forward to listening to it. Thank you for your time. Say hello to everybody at the Better Government Association.
Will do, John. Appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Reading from our next guest piece, which I found at thehill.com. To list the examples of what constitutes cancel culture, one would risk becoming a statistician of gutter trivia. That's a great opening line. Whether we're dealing with removing the American flag, tearing down monuments, scrapping classic texts from college curricula, or people losing their jobs because of some transgression they may have committed decades ago, basically, we're heading back to the Puritans. Let's welcome Jason Hill, professor of philosophy at DePaul University here, specialized in ethics, social, and political philosophy,
American Foreign Policy, American Politics. Author of several books, including the forthcoming book, What Do White Americans Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Oppression. Dr. Professor Hill, welcome to WDL, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, I found this piece fascinating. I did have to whip out the thesaurus a couple times, I must say. It's a very well-written piece. What exactly are they attempting to do with the cancel culture, in your view?
Well, I think that they're trying to do two things. One is they're really trying to erase the agency of individuals. They're trying to undermine your self-esteem, your confidence to judge for yourself. They're really trying to just sort of cancel agency. But the real thing that they're trying to do, you know, whether they're canceling monuments, whether they're firing people, whether they are taking away college courses from professors such as myself, is they're trying to cancel Western civilization. They're trying to annihilate the United States as we know it in order to bring about a new world order.
Well, now let's stop there and just define who they are specifically.
Well, there are various organizations, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it is Antifa, whether it is the advocates of critical race theory. What I find very interesting is that there are a number of groups that have differences among themselves, but in spite of these seemingly intractable differences, they have one goal in common. They hate America, they hate capitalism, they hate Western civilization. So whether we're talking about Black Lives Matter, the critical race theory movement, which is a big, which has become our national philosophy, which is nothing but a racial extinction doctrine to annihilate white people from the face of this earth.
Whoa. Just elaborate on that just a little bit. You're going to have to back that up with some attribution for me.
Well, critical race theory basically is the view that systemic racism suffuses every institution and every organization of this country, and that if you are the possessor of white skin, that you not just possess white privilege, but that you're a walking practitioner of racism, and that you are an oppressor just by having white skin. So we have in K-12 all these sorts of horrific programs, which I've investigated and I've written about, where, you know, you have teachers telling the white kids to put their hands beside a brown paper bag, and if there's a difference in the color, that they're to look around and apologize to all the black kids because they're part of a problem called systemic racism.
That's stupid for teachers to do that. Now, but why, you know, how would you teach kids the stain of slavery in American history in elementary school? Describing what you think is a more apropos way of teaching slavery.
I would teach them that America was born with a horrific birth defect called slavery, that we had a constitution that, by the way, does not mention the word race in it, and that the foundations for black freedom were built into the constitution, the inalienability of all human beings, the God-given rights that Martin Luther King himself invoked during the civil rights movement. I would teach it factually, that make no bones about it, that America's had a horrific history.
Well, yeah, but the point, yeah, and I agree with you on that, and I think it should be taught. I think it should be taught reasonably. I don't, for having kids put their hands next to a brown paper bag is ridiculous, waste of time. That being said, you told me that those who are for critical race theory want to wipe me off the face of the earth. I find that to be an overstatement.
No, it's not an overstatement. You know why? Because they have something called the abolitionist movement, and the abolitionist movement has as its explicit goal the abolition of whiteness.
Now, who is that?
An academic.
I've not heard of that movement. Who are those people?
Well, these are people like Ibram Kendi. These are people like these are academics within the institution that there is something called critical white studies. There's something called abolition of whiteness in universities that are taught in not just black and diasporic studies, but that are part and parcel of that I deal with explicitly in my forthcoming book. I have a whole chapter devoted to these programs that are trickled into the K-12 programs. And they're not called kill white people, but they're called abolitionist programs. And what they do is they call for the abolition of whiteness under the guise of whiteness studies.
Do you think it's inappropriate to tear down monuments of Confederates?
I think that's an open question that people can have reasonable debates about. I mean, I think that Confederates, it's part of our history, and that you cannot sort of cancel history. I think those monuments could be put in a museum. But I think when you look at I've watched carefully how these people go about tearing down statues. They tear down the statues of both abolitionists, including black individuals who fought in the Civil War in Boston. There were a number of statues of black freedom fighters, and they tear down the statues of Confederates as well.
Those are ignorant mobs. You know, those are ignorant mobs. So I don't really give them much credibility. Isn't this all about, especially in a high school setting or a collegiate setting, about being able to moderate debates and teach both sides, or at least allow the kids full information so they can make their own minds up, adjudicating disputes?
I think that would be the ideal situation, but that's not what is happening. And again, someone who has been a professor for 25 years in the classroom, I have seen where if you have a rejoinder, if you have an alternative viewpoint, not only are you not allowed to advance that viewpoint, you are punished for having that viewpoint.
Yeah. In fact, you mentioned that earlier, one of your courses have been canceled at DePaul. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Well, there are many courses that I've taught, including the philosopher John Locke and Aristotle and John Stuart Mill, where I've had students tell me that they're not going to read the works of white supremacist males.
Can't you just fail them? And I'd say, okay, well, don't read the book. You fail the course. Next question.
Well, they don't mind. They're activists and they're radicals, and they would rather take the failing grade on principle. Yeah. This is what's quite dangerous, that we're dealing with a set of really radical individuals who, on principle, will take a failing grade.
Well, what I hate is when speakers are either shouted down at college campuses now. Primarily, I guess, conservative speakers are shouted down, not allowed to speak, when they're not advocating violence against anybody. They're just talking about John Locke or Stuart Mill or Hume, whomever. And that irritates me to no end. I don't think I see it as apocalyptic as you do, but then I'm not involved in an institution of higher learning like you are. Must be very frustrating.
Well, when you have in the state of California under ethnic studies programs, and it's you just Google it and you can see it. I've written two articles on this. When you have in California under the ethnic studies programs that are part and parcel of the critical race theory program, a denigration of Christianity, and you have children facing the West worshiping Aztec gods, okay, in the state of California worshiping Aztec gods and being told that the Judeo-Christian God is a white supremacist God. This is in the public schools in California. I don't think I'm being an apocalypticist, and
Those teachers should be fired. Right. Unless they're just kids being kids, if that's part of the curriculum, then you know what? I have a problem with that, and the teachers should have to pay for it.
I agree, but I think this problem is much more widespread, and I think when you have parents who are outraged and are now being labeled as domestic terrorists, as our current administration
Well,
is
I think
to.
That's because they're screaming at school boards over mask mandates, which the school board doesn't have much to say about when they're, a gubernatorial edict. So let's not confuse the issues. Professor, I am out of time. I enjoyed the piece a great deal. I'm looking forward to seeing the book as well. And I hope to have you back at some point. Thank you. Jason Hill, professor of philosophy at DePaul University here on WLS.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Our next guest, Jeremiah Joyce. He's a lawyer. He served Chicago, first as a Chicago police detective in the 60s. Alderman in the 70s, state senator in the 80s into the 90s, so he's been in the thick of it his entire career. I have his memoir in my hand. The book is titled Still Burning, Half a Century of Chicago from the Streets to the Corridors of Power, a Memoir. Mr. Joyce, welcome to the program. How are you, sir?
Good, thank you. Thank you.
A very good friend of mine, grew up certainly near you. He's about your age. He grew up in Chatham. I guess you grew up just a little north and west in Park Manor. But when I mentioned to him that you had been part of a heist at the Swift ice cream factory, he just started laughing, because I guess it was well known that the kids knew that skylight was pretty much open, and if you wanted ice cream, all you had to do was get through the skylight. Can you tell us that early memory, the listeners, about breaking into the Swift ice cream plant?
Oh, that is funny. I never realized that other people. I was about 5 or 6 years old, and some of the older kids were 10 or 11 and lived across the street from me. My sister, who was 2 years older than I, we took a trip over, a walkover. It was a few blocks from our house, and we went up on the roof, and I was lowered down through a hatch to take some ice cream off the pallets. And when I got home, I had left my jacket. I didn't realize that I had left my jacket. Dropped my jacket. It dropped down. So I had to confess to my mom what happened to the jacket. She promptly took me back over there, and people at the ice cream plant denied it, but they went up on the stack and found the jacket. So that was one of my probably one of my first deviations from proper behavior as a child.
It's a great story, the fact that your mom was as mad at the Swift ice cream people for leaving that skylight ajar so the kids could break in and hurt themselves as she was at you for going in there and getting some ice cream cones. Mr. Joyce, when you were – the picture on the memoir is terrific, too. It's from the Days of Rage. I assume this is when you were undercover for the Chicago police, and this is what, during the summer of 69?
That was in 69, but I wasn't undercover in the sense of what most people think of that term. I was always obvious.
Yeah. So plain clothes, I should have said.
I knew most. Pardon me?
I should have said plain clothes. You were obviously a cop, yeah. But you weren't in the traditional uniform, sure.
No, and most of the people that were involved in it knew my name and knew what I was doing. It turned when the, That picture is from the Days of Rage, and you can see in that photo, you can see a lot of young kids that were basically just a little maybe out of high school or still in high school, and I put it on there because to me that was symbolic of the mistake that those radicals, the ones who went into the Weather Underground, that was a mistake they made when they started to bring the young kids out and throwing them into the fray.
Yeah. Jeremiah Joyce is here. The new memoir is called Still Burning. It's available now. I recommend it if you love Chicago history. You mentioned early in the book that St. Sabina, the parish, tried to tamp down racial tensions back then and try to prevent the white flight. Unfortunately, they weren't successful, and race permeates everything in Chicago to this day. What were the biggest mistakes made even all those years ago and that we're still paying the price for now?
Well, we had moved fairly well along to a program that was going to deal with that block-by-block resegregation that had basically plagued all of the major cities in the North during the 50s and the 60s. And then there was an incident in which a young high school student was killed, shot, and a girl was shot. And that just rippled through the neighborhood, and there was no turning back on that. All the for sale signs went up on the houses. The real estate panic peddlers and all those who come in to profit off of the changing neighborhoods in those days came in, and they just overwhelmed it within 6 months.
When you see what's going on, as a former cop, and this is Jeremiah Joyce, former police officer, alderman, state senator, has a new book out called Still Burning. When you see the riots from last summer and the crime epidemic that we suffer from in the city now, if the current mayor was coming to you for suggestions on what to do regarding police tactics and community relations and maybe some suggestions for the state's attorney, how much trouble do you think the city is in currently in 2021?
Well, there's a lot of trouble right now, and the bane of good city policing is anonymity, and you have to have a program that would establish a real familiarity with those who are responsible for policing the community and those who live in the community. And there are ways to do that, but I don't see the will or the belief in a way to do that on the part of anybody right now in Chicago. But if you had a system where the police officers were assigned to a particular precinct and they were going to be there for a long period of time, and they knew that for 3 or 4 years or so, I think that would probably go a long way in trying to deal with some of what's going on right now. But I don't understand all of it right now because of cell phones and the internet and the availability of guns and what motivates and what causes all these shootings. So I don't know if it's gone beyond something like that. And I think, and I had talked about for a long time, if they would send in maybe 1,000 or 2,000 ATF people into Chicago that would not have any responsibility for arresting anybody, and all they had to do was to try to get guns off the street in a way that doesn't offend or violate anybody's rights. I don't know. There are a lot of their thoughts out there, and I just don't know if they have the resources or if they have the willpower. They certainly are demoralizing the police.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Jeremiah Joyce is here. His new memoir is Still Burning, Half a Century of Chicago from the Streets to the Corridors of Power. Former Chicago police officer, then an alderman, then a state senator for a number of years. Who was the most fascinating political figure, whether it was Richard J. Daley, Richard M. Daley, Blandick, who you write, nobody could follow Richard J. Daley. Blandick, of course, made his mistake with the snow situation. But who was the most dominating, fascinating political figure in your days, either working here at City Hall or down in Springfield?
I would say Richard M. Daley, because I was so closely involved with him. But there are some other figures that were pretty fascinating. I thought that Governor Thompson was pretty fascinating. And then there were some persons that I served in the city council with that but at the time I was city council, there was no member of the city council that was ever charged with an offense for any activity or any thing that went on in the city council.
Really? So the time you were you were alderman from the 19th ward from 75 to 79, and 0.0 of your colleagues were ever charged in that time?
That's correct.
Wow.
That's those correct.
Did you have a regular meal at Counselor's Row, that restaurant that became so notorious?
No, I didn't. I did not have a regular meal for it. At the first ward table in Counselor's Row, no.
With Fred Rohde and Pat Marcy?
With Fred, yeah. Yeah.
Unless you're really, you want to steer clear of that. Well, I think I've only read about 75 pages, but it's just a well-written book. Congratulations. Also, I thought your son made a nice run in the mayoral contest previously, so please say hello to him for me, and I hope you sell a ton of these books.
Thank you, John.
Nice talking with you. Jeremiah Joyce here. The memoir is Still Burning. Look for it. If you like Chicago history, you'll love the book.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
Have you been hacked yet? I mean, if you're a business owner, you probably worry about it. Personally, individuals get hacked all the time. You open your laptop one morning, see a note explaining that your files are now encrypted. What? Only the attackers hold the key. Have you heard about Bitcoin? They shake you down. Well, not only is ransomware a criminal enterprise, but as our next guest will explain, it is now a very powerful weapon in political warfare by states or surrogates of states. Let's welcome Dr. Kirill Avramov. He is an assistant professor in the Center for Russian, Eastern European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Texas. And I saw he co-authored a piece at thehill.com. Doctor, thanks for your time this evening. How powerful is this weapon for, in essence, political warfare going forward?
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. I believe that we're dealing with a new instrument and very powerful at that within the toolbox of what we call active measures. And active measures are a well-known method of conducting political warfare, specifically from state actors. In this case, we're talking about Russia, which we associate with disinformation, propaganda, destabilization, eroding of trust. However, with the development of new technologies, and specifically the ransom as a service model, we are entering a new phase. Because from the perspective that I've mentioned of political warfare and active measures, this type of malicious behavior represents a perfect opportunity for what we call plausible deniability.
Yeah.
And that has not been able to pinpoint immediately the actor and tie it to the state actor that might be supporting it. However, what we see, we do have a suspicious alignment of those activities when they select and hit targets, and the overall political objectives, especially in this complicated situation, which could be described as a gray zone conflict, and that is activities below the threshold of war, but yet they are destructive and cause harm. It is interesting to think about the pattern, and this is what we were suggesting with my co-author, to look for assessments from the intel community on the arrangements, which are very opaque, between those seemingly disconnected operators, right. And usually what we would suggest to look at the human element, and intelligence services, which usually would co-opt.
Right. And in other words, Putin has plausible deniability because they're in Russia, or they're in China, or they're in Iran, or as I've heard our former president say, some 400-pound guy in some basement somewhere. So they have plausible deniability. But how do we, number one, stop them from attacking us, or get Putin or whomever to sit on them, because they're going to pay? In other words, we're going to exact a retribution from Putin, even if he says, I had nothing to do with it.
Well, first of all, several important things, because you're raising a very important question, is how to deal with this type of activity. First of all, you know, most of those operators are shielded because there will be no extradition if they operate from their soil. Also, it's also very important. That's why the reason I mentioned previously about carefully studying the patterns and the links between the existing links between those operators and governmental entities, because here we're entering a very dangerous zone of misattribution, and that could lead to further escalation with very unpleasant consequences.
Well,
however,
the consequences, let me pause there. I mean, at some point you have to let the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, or whomever know that the Israeli model, you hit us once, we hit you back twice. I don't care where the people are. They're in your orbit. They're under your control, if not directly, obliquely, as you pointed out earlier. I don't care about the plausible deniability, but as a democracy or representative republic, do we have the leeway to do that? Or are we doing it?
Well, you know, it has been pointed out by this administration, there are several ways, and as we pointed out in our opinion, first of all, it should be brought to the attention, as already has been brought to Putin and his governmental officials, and there are multiple ways to do so. First of all, to seek counterintuitively cooperation in order to see and disrupt specifically what we think is very important, and that is the mechanisms of ransom to cash conversion on platforms that are residing on their soil. If those do not bear fruit, you know, then think about offensive measures, shutting down servers and so on. I mean, there are multiple ways which I think could be utilized with not only cyber measures, but let me just draw to your attention that usually sanctions do work. They are a pretty good instrument to remind and sometimes deter.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic? Are you optimistic or pessimistic about our response, our ability to respond to ransomware and attacks, cyber attacks?
I am actually pretty optimistic. I think that there is a level of strategic patience, which is tied to what I was referring before, as to establishing a clear pattern and having an evidence. But I'm also very concerned by the fact that this year alone we have literally an explosion, exponential growth of those attacks, and there is a strong incentive for decentralization of those actors. So it will require a lot of energy and attention. However, going back to my initial thought, it should not be seen separately, in my mind at least, and my research associates from other instruments, which are pretty powerful, as we know, and disruptive to national security of this country.
Well, I wish I could share your optimism. I'll read more. Thank you, Doctor, for your time. We'll make sure we make your article available on our social media platforms, and my best to you and your colleagues at the University of Texas.
Thank you very much, sir.
Take care. That is Dr. Kirill Avramov, and again, you can read the piece at thehill.com. We'll make sure it's available on our platforms as well, but I'm glad to hear that he's optimistic.
This is John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.
First reported by Mary Ann Ahern over there at NBC, Mayor Lori Lightfoot complained to Joe Biden's staff that she was not scheduled to speak at the event in Elk Grove Village, and that's why she did not attend. She met him at the airport, I believe shook his hand, and then when she found out she wasn't speaking, skedaddled. She can be a bit prickly.
These young women who have come forward and at risk to themselves in difficult circumstances, probably re-traumatizing themselves by having to relive what they experienced, they deserve justice, and I'm determined to make sure that that happens.
We'll get to that story. An update. I guess she did speak briefly at the event in Elk Grove Village and then skedaddled before the president spoke. Did not stick around for that. Well, she's busy, too. There's a lot going on in the city, including the fact that the Chicago Park District has now hired some high-priced consultants to try to help with the sex abuse allegations and the scandal that has been swirling over there at the Park District, putting CEO Michael Kelly on the hot seat, and others have been fired, others have left. The mayor's involved now, the state's attorney is involved now, Kim Fox. Dan Mithilopoulos is the man that broke the story months ago, an investigative reporter for years here in the city. He's now over at WBEZ and Public Radio on their government and politics team. Dan, reading from your piece today, what kind of help have they retained and at what cost?
So they've hired a former Cook County prosecutor, former first assistant state's attorney, Bob Mylan, and his company called Pression Comply to revamp their policies and their procedures involving sexual harassment and other misconduct. And they're also paying tens of thousands of dollars so he could set up something that is a new branch, effectively, of the Park District, which will be called the Office of Protection and will kick off after the new year. So they have a four-month contract at $425 an hour for the services of Bob Mylan to do these tasks as they try to grapple with a broadening scandal involving dozens of allegations of harassment, abuse, and assault against lifeguards at the city's public beaches and pools.
Dan, I recognize that name, Mylan. Didn't he run for state's attorney years ago?
Yeah, he was the first assistant state's attorney under Dick Devine, and when Dick Devine left in 2007, he ran and lost in a crowded field for the Democratic nomination to replace Dick Devine as a top prosecutor in Cook County.
Is there any ceiling on the amount of money that he can build a park district to go through this scandal?
No, there isn't right now. We looked at the contract. We got it through a Freedom of Information Act request. You know, this is another case where the park district has been less than transparent. But we did file a Freedom of Information Act request. And in this case, they gave us the contract. We heard about it. They didn't say publicly that they were going to hire him. They said they had outside consultants. We found out it was Mylan's company, and they're estimating that the cost will be from $25,000 to $40,000 for the first three tasks of a five-phase plan that they have in this contract. And the last two parts, to create a case management system and to train employees who are going to participate in this Office of Protection, the cost of those last two phases is to be determined. So, no, we don't know what the cap will be.
I always say never confuse activity with accomplishment. This is like closing the barn door after the horses are gone.
Yeah, I did speak with one former lifeguard who alleged that she was abused, and I told her about this Office of Protection, and she said to me that what they should be doing is preventing sexual harassment and abuse from happening, not creating another place where you can go after it's already happened. And by the way, when I say that there's other places they can go, there's an inspector general there. And if there is abuse or assault, which is criminal, they can go to law enforcement, to police, to the state's attorney. So some people believe that they may be creating this Office of Protection as a way to nip some of these situations in the bud before they start having an inspector general or some outside authority looking at how they're handling these complaints. It's been a big problem for them. They have the state's attorney looking into how they've handled these complaints. They've had to hire an outside lawyer after their inspector general resigned due to some problems and questions in her background. And so they're also potentially police that could be looking into this. So to set up an Office of Protection within there, they say this is a first of its kind thing that'll be a model for the country. But is it really something that is necessary? And it's something that's going to cost some money.
Dan Mithilopoulos is here. He's a longtime investigative reporter in town. He's now over at WBEZ, Government and Politics team. What is the latest on CEO Michael Kelly and his chances to continue in his position?
CEO Michael Kelly has said that he won't resign. I count, I think, five or six aldermen now who say that he should resign. The first, I believe, was Scott Wagispack, the Finance Committee Chairman, and some others have joined in, Rosana Rodriguez Sanchez, Andre Vasquez, Michelle Smith, and the list is growing as we speak of people calling for him to resign. But there are 50 members in the council, and I do want to point out the vast majority have not said anything as we've rolled out these stories over months and months this year.
Aren't Kelly and Milan from the same neighborhood, the same political background?
Well, they're first of all from the 19th Ward. You know, both of them are from the 19th Ward on the far southwest side. It's one of the most clout heavy wards. It's the Beverly end of the clout heavy Beverly to Bridgeport corridor, as we say in that White Sox song, right? And that's a part of town that's, yes, been very influential in the Democratic Party in Chicago and in Illinois for generations. And, yes, both of them are from there.
Dan, thanks again for the update. Much appreciated. We'll read more and listen for more at Chicago Public Radio. I appreciate you jumping over and slumming on the AM side this afternoon.
Not at all. It's my pleasure, my honor, and thank you for the opportunity to bring the story to your audience as well.
Of course I should have known about this at the time that Mike Kelly and Avis Lavelle were notified, and I've made very clear that that was a mistake on their point. They should have read me in. But the most important thing is that the state's attorney has her role to fulfill, and that needs to move forward, but also the investigation needs to continue.
John Howell, Essential Cuts. Check back every weekday for another episode of John Howell, Essential Cuts on 890 WLS.